Visible is a wireless carrier that is not invisible. It is pretty clear from the name. Actually, radio waves are invisible. And I can say this with authority as a licensed amateur radio operator. That being said, Visible won't be giving you the power to see light outside the visible spectrum. It's actually way better because having that ability would make getting around very difficult and distracting. What you do get with Visible is unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. You get one line of wireless, just $25 a month, which is great in these times of economic uncertainty. That is one line for $25, taxes and fees included. So whatever you're doing at this moment, please stop. Switch immediately. Now, monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com. Wir gerne sehen, was ist los? It's deinen Freund Seth. I'm learning German. Yeah, in case you didn't know what that was. That is me trying to impress you with the little German that I know. Right now, I am actually learning German. I took it in high school. I goofed off the entire time. I did some other language learning apps. They taught me things like where the taxi stand is and how to find a bus, but not a lot of conversational German. Thankfully, that's what Babbel is all about. Babbel teaches you language conversationally, which, let's face it, that is what you want to know anyway. I don't know. When I was in school, you learned like how to count. You learned like the colors. You learned the shapes. Those are all important things, but they don't help you when you're in like Cologne, Germany with Ein Nierenstein, which, by the way, is German for kidney stone, an experience I can unfortunately speak personally to. But I've been using Babbel to learn to speak German again, better than I have before. I actually really like it because it is conversational. It's a little bit more relaxed. One of the things that it does that I really like is it'll sometimes show you what the literal English translation is. And I don't know why, but I find that very helpful in sort of understanding the structure, the grammar of a language and sort of putting myself into that mind space. Since I'm only in Germany for Gamescom, which is like a week, week and a half, I'm not immersed in the German language. I'm not immersed in German culture. So what I do is the second best thing. I'm taking Babbel. Hopefully this year when I go to Germany, I'll be able to impress all the Germans with how much German I know from learning through Babbel. The app has pronunciation recognition, so you'll be able to learn how to speak better with your accent, how to actually properly pronounce the words. That way you won't get made fun of by a group of older German men because you said Apfelstrudel and not Apfelstrudel. No, it's really cool. I'm going to say right now there is a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now you can get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners, because you guys are the best ones, by the way, at babbel.com/realm. Get 60% off at babbel.com/realm. That is spelled babbel.com/realm. Rules and restrictions may apply.
This episode is brought to you by Gamefly, the best way to rent or buy your favorite games. Listen.
Welcome to Nintendo Voice Chat, episode 381. My name is Philip Musin, and today we have a bunch of Switch updates and news and a ton of games coming out this week. I'm super excited about, and I'm joined, I'll start to my right here with, I think you guys have met this one, wonderful man before. His name is Per Schneider.
Hello. Thanks for having me on the show.
Great to have you here.
This is my
today,
first
Per.
Time on NVC. Very excited to be joining.
Good job.
Finally. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Over to my far left, let's go over to Zach Ryan. How you
it's
doing
me.
Today?
I'm all right. I'm good. Cool.
You okay? You're a little down. Is that because that one block
well, I was
in
trying
Mario
to get
got
this,
you down?
I was trying to get the Jaxi block in the Sand Kingdom right. and I missed it twice and right. It just really bummed me out.
All right. Well.
But other than that, I'm doing fine.
If you want us to do it for you, just let us know.
Don't patronize me, Per. Don't patronize me.
And over right here to my direct left is Mr. Brian Altano.
Welcome. Hello. Thanks for having me. I only have 3 moons left in Mario Odyssey, and they're all tied to Bound Ball,
which is the worst. So I'm basically not playing Mario Odyssey. I'm basically playing a shovelware game at this point.
Why don't you just buy three moons from
it doesn't count. You can't do it. Doesn't count. You gotta get the check marks next to everything. Right. You gotta light up
that last light on the Odyssey.
Anyway.
All right, good. Yeah.
Well, before we break into our main topics today, I did want to read one of our iTunes reviews because this podcast solely runs off of iTunes reviews, 5 stars only, yeah. Right? So definitely make sure if you have time.
It's the power moons to our iTunes Odyssey. Yep.
That's basically what keeps all of us going. We don't need food. We just need iTunes reviews.
That's true. I eat them.
Yes. So I wanted to read one left by Mr. Ryan Darmos. He said, top-notch dudes, 5 stars. I always love listening to this podcast. Each personality brings something to the table, and I'm 100% confident that you guys convinced me to buy a Switch. When Brian Boitano was in the Olympics skating for the gold, he did 2 slachos and a triple Lutz while wearing a blindfold.
Good man.
Great.
Yeah.
Do you get the Boitano thing a lot?
Not anymore.
It's over now, huh?
Yeah. You know what? Because I think I outlived that dude.
Ryan.
No, he's still alive.
Really? No, he must be still
alive. I think he is still alive, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah,
well, you know, he's out triple Lutz'd me and double Salchos, so I think we're good. Let's
take a moment to talk about these random Snapple facts in this review. If you're leaving us an iTunes review, please say some glowing remarks about each of us, but then also tell us something that we didn't know, this Brian Boitano fact.
Yeah, very good.
That's nice.
Cool. Yeah. The blindfold thing, that's interesting.
Awesome. Very cool. So let's go ahead and easily segue right into our first major topic, I guess, of the week. And we just had a Xenoblade 2 Direct where we learned a bunch of new information. We got some Zelda DLC just today, actually, as of our recording.
I gotta go get that, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So did any of you guys get a chance to play it at all, the DLC? It actually launched at midnight last night.
No, I didn't have a chance between then and now, but it's...
I slept.
Did you guys read about how to get it? It's effectively like these like sort of like objects have landed at 3 separate locations throughout the world and you have to go find them.
Yep.
I think what like...
Are they marked?
It's an invasion.
Yeah. So, well, they're like clues that you get. So like a objective will pop up in your quest log like it always does. And then you get some weird like sort of assless chap pants that you get that show the sides of Link's legs. And that it's
been asking for those, so finally.
Since day one, day zero. Yeah. But they're kind of Kingdom Heartsy, the costume. Like, it's obviously Xenoblade, but, I'd be more interested in like a cool new sword or something like that. So I didn't know if that's necessarily part of it.
Wasn't there a weapon included?
I hope so.
With the whole armor set? I think that you do end up getting the Xenoblade. I'm not 100% sure on that. I actually haven't even started it myself.
Yep.
But, I do know that you can get the full armor set, right? And then once you do get all of that, it gives you a pretty good buff, right? Once you equip everything. I think like certain items have to be upgraded, but it seems cool. Zach, did you check it out at all?
I haven't checked it out. I want to. I'm glad that it's actually tied to a side quest and not just like one of the things that sort of not bummed me out, but I thought that they could have done a little bit better in the first DLC for Breath of the Wild was they just dropped a bunch of chests into the world and were like, hey, here's where all that gear is. Go find it.
Yeah.
It wasn't necessarily like they weren't tied to specific quests.
That was literally how the season pass thing worked.
Yeah. So I like that this one makes you work for it a little bit and it gives you a little more incentive to get back into Breath of the Wild and into that world. Like I don't care about the Xeno saga or Xeno gear.
or Blade.
Xenoblade.
The titles even.
You don't like, really.
Armor. Yeah. But I do think that it's Xenomorphs. I do think that it's cool that there's a lengthy quest that
couldn't have predicted this one though. Like I didn't even think about the fact that they're doing these kind of tie-in promos. It's a welcome surprise. I think it's really cool. I'm going to boot it back up.
Do you think that it's a little backwards? Like, do you think that putting Link in Xenoblade armor is not as useful as it would have been to put like Zelda DLC into Xenoblade. Like I feel like, you know, like I don't know, like as a bigger Zelda fan and Zelda being a bigger franchise, like
give them time.
Right? Maybe they'll return the favor. Yeah.
I mean, I think that because Xenoblade is what, like a month away, they probably, like, this is Nintendo's chance to sort of bring awareness to that.
Yeah.
You know, like, everybody's gonna load up, you know, Breath of the Wild, or they'll see that, you know, something automatically downloaded. Then, Xenoblade Quest, what's Xenoblade if they don't know what it's about?
Sure.
Well, we take one look at those assless chaps, and I mean, you're probably in, like,
who could refuse, right?
That's it.
Yeah. I'm sorry that I said the wrong name. There's a lot of Xeno games.
It's fine.
I'm sorry, I'm apologizing to you out there.
Well, we're gonna make you play it. It's just 120 hours to finish.
Talking about the direct that happened this week, like I'm excited to play it. Mm-hmm. I think that one of the last check boxes on the Switch this year is like a really deep JRPG. So let's have it.
Yeah. My only worry is that I might get stuck in Skyrim, and then
literally
there's
like
another 100
stuck in the geometry
RPG
in Skyrim.
Happens a lot. Yeah.
But no, it's awesome. I think it's great. Too many games to play. That's so cool.
Well, it's like one thing that there's all these games to play, but there's also all these other games that are making me go back to them. Yeah. Not making me, but they're nudging me. And I think like with the Zelda DLC coming eventually, right? Probably this year, we keep hearing.
It's this year.
And then the stuff that just launched now, it's like, okay, well, like I want to start playing a bunch of these new games, but all the old ones keep pulling me back. I had the same thing with you and I were playing Horizon just the other day.
Yeah.
Which I wouldn't have guessed with all the new games coming out, but I'm glad I went back.
Yeah, know? Me too.
Yeah. Did you review the first Xenoblade?
No, I didn't. Last one? No. I haven't ever completed a Xenoblade game before.
You didn't play for 275,000 hours to finish the Xenoblade.
Unfortunately,
it's the
average
completion time. Some people are a little faster.
Yeah, it's two full calendar years. Yeah.
But I am running through the 3DS version right now. So.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I'm excited.
Why are you doing that to yourself? Wasn't that version like pretty bad?
No.
No, I think it's fine.
Good.
Was it?
Yeah. You think of Hyrule Warriors.
Yeah, but that was one of the only other games that needed the new 3DS processor, right?
It's not at the same level on a technical, like, aspects of like the Wii U version, but it's like a totally comparable port.
Yeah, it's good.
Like the resolution gets a little not great when you're like really far from things. You know, you can't tell if it's like a tree
or
a bad
guy. But the 3DS like really far away from you.
That's the trick.
It's really, really small.
Yeah, I play most of my 3DS games through a telescope. Yeah,
which just gets me even more excited, you know, by the fact that Xenoblade Chronicles 2 is coming out on Switch and we're going to be able to have that option to, you know, play it at home on TV or just take it portably with us on
really
the go.
Cool.
It's incredible.
Yeah, I played this game at Gamescom, and then I think we played it again at PAX.
Yeah,
was that one of we previewed it? Yeah,
yeah.
And it's got a lot going for it. It's really ambitious. It's gigantic. It's everything you want from it. The battle system is legitimately like heavy duty serious. Like it's not one of those like sort of run up on an enemy, jam on them, grind, and move on to the next one. You engage in a battle in this game, and it's an event. It's a whole thing.
The depth of this battle system is insane, and in the direct. They spent a good portion of the time talking about the battle system and how it works and like how the character upgrades work and the way that they were like stacking terms on top of terms. I saw this in the NVC podcast forums on Facebook. People were like, is anybody else really intimidated by Xenoblade 2? Because
yeah, totally.
It looks really, really deep.
So thank you for saying that.
So Andrew played it a bunch. He couldn't join today, but he's got a full preview of the game up. By the time you watch this.
Yeah, he's got a really cool developer walkthrough.
He was very excited about over the battle system. He said it's really, really
good. He's one of those people that can, like a lot of JRPG fans, can really lock into a system that gets this intense, right? And really pull apart the minutia of it, collect every little thing. Mm-hmm. He's a total completionist when it comes to games too, so I see him falling even further down the well here. But with me, as someone who like sort of nowadays only casually plays RPGs, I did find the system intimidating, but I also found myself like sort of growing to it after a little while. So I think there's going to be a lot here. And this is like Zach said, like we're kind of missing this gigantic JRPG on the system. You know, the last one we really had was like I Am Setsuna, and that's such a different situation.
It's a small big game.
This is a big
RPG in the works for, you know, many, many months. So it's pretty cool. But you've been playing a different game for a while, huh?
Yes, I have been working on my review for a little AAA shooter called Doom, actually,
Doom?
For Switch. Yeah.
Is this your first IGN review?
This is my very first IGN review, so I'm really, really excited. It should be, by the time this podcast is out, that should be out as well, so you guys should be able to check it out. I guess we can talk about everything.
Yeah. You had one of those great moments that are, to me, like, when I think about IGN, why I love it, and you know, when years from now, when I'm a retired old man, and I think about, I look back on like my favorite moments from IGN, it's when something is happening in the office that attracts a large group of people to kind of stand around and gawk at.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's a negative thing where we're like, oh man, this doesn't look good. But sometimes like this, you were playing the Switch version of Doom, and everyone gathered around a big 4K television to watch you play this game, and we all just were sort of like, it's Doom.
Yeah.
They did it.
Yeah.
Like, and to me, I think what it surmised was that a lot of the excuses that we have historically heard from third parties about not being able to port things here and there when it comes to Nintendo and their underpowered consoles, that's kind of gets thrown out the window here.
They're going to make it look easy, right?
Obviously, yeah,
it's a step down, right? You noted this in the review. It's 30 frames per second, not 60. Right. Some of the sheen is missing.
Yeah.
Right.
But it runs nicely and it feels right.
Right. I think it's a completely competent port of Doom. You know, yeah. I think it works excellent on Switch. Obviously, you're not going to get, you know, the high fidelity graphics that we'd get like on a PC or PS4 or Xbox One. But that doesn't really matter because the gameplay itself is what is the selling point for this game. And the game is a lot of fun and it's perfect on Switch because it does have that sort of pick up and play mentality. Mm-hmm. Like there is a great story in Doom. I really enjoyed Doom's story, but at the same time, it's not something that you really have to pay attention to.
And it's got that arcade mode on top of it. Too,
yeah, right? There's an arcade mode in there. It's got the multiplayer. The only thing it's missing is the Snap Map editor, which I think it would have been pretty cool to have that option because the Switch is such a social system to be able to like play with each other like that and share maps with each other.
I wonder if that's the kind of scenario where Bethesda is sort of watching to see how well this one resonates and if they have time to add that kind of stuff later. Cause I know the multiplayer aspects of this game are sort of a piecemeal download from everything else, right? When you buy the game or you download the game, you're only really getting the single player and the multiplayer is a completely separate download on top of everything else. So if they're analyzing it like that and there's like the single player, multiplayer, maybe the snap map thing is something that can show up down the line if a bunch of people buy this game.
Yeah, I could definitely see something like that happen.
Yeah.
It's cool.
And how does it perform in handheld mode?
Oh, yeah, handheld?
Yeah.
So I played it handheld. I haven't played it docked yet. You obviously played it both. But handheld, it's just surprising when you see the game run that it's on this thin thing, right? Like it's amazing. But when you put this even next to some of the redesigned smaller consoles, it's like it's so tiny and it's running this game that is pretty damn good looking lighting wise and everything. Yeah.
If you're watching the video version of this podcast, you're seeing the IGN graphics comparison that we made between the Switch, PC, Xbox One and PS4.
Yep.
And it reminds me a lot like graphically of the beginning of this console cycle when we saw games that came out for PS3 and PS4 or Xbox 360 and Xbox One. The fidelity isn't too far off.
Like, No.
It's a little muddier. That you ran into some frame issues, Philip. Like, you ran into a little.
There were
some frame rate issues. Yeah.
Actually, you know, it didn't seem to matter if I was playing docked or undocked.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of slowdown.
Right. They weren't too clear on, you know, what the exact resolution was. So to me, it appears to be dynamic.
Uh-huh.
And it caps out at 720p, whether or not you're playing in TV mode and of course in handheld mode as well.
Yeah.
So when you're playing in TV mode, especially if you have a big screen TV, you're going to see those lower resolution textures. I mean, even something like the crosshair itself.
Yeah.
Is a little blown out and that can be a little annoying while you're playing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was going to say in terms of that, like, I think that's what makes Doom sort of a great choice for the kind of first really genuinely premier first person shooter on the Nintendo Switch. Cause I think something like Call of Duty that is so much more, like influenced or hinges on like sort of ranged weaponry. A lot of times you have a lot of sniper rifle stuff. Doom is such an up close and personal melee driven game. It's about shotguns. It's about just really smashing that dude's face in and you gotta be there for that. And I think the resolution loss when it comes to hitting enemies from a distance could be sort of a cumbersome thing, especially on the Switch screen at 720p. But I think for what they're going with here, I think it's a fantastic.
You know what else makes it perfect? What? No trees. Trees are notoriously difficult to do, and on, you know, the more hardware power you have, obviously the better and the more detail you can put into them. So a game on Mars is perfect.
Yeah, it's great. That's why Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, zero trees.
It does have trees, but they're not amazing.
No, they're not great.
Let's be honest, right?
If we were to rank the greatest trees in video games, which I'm sure we will.
Yeah.
At some point before this website gets shut down. Just
hold tight. We'll get there eventually.
We got one more.
I don't know if Breath of the Wild will be up there. Cool. So people can find your review on IGN.
I've heard of this site.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. IGN. I'm sure it'll be on YouTube as well.
Yeah, sure.
Yep. And our graphic comparison as well, if you want to see what
that's up now. Yeah. You can check that out.
It's awesome.
Yeah,
I'm excited to start that.
Yeah, and then so what else is coming out this week? It looks like we have another smaller game, another indie title called L.A. Noire.
Yep.
La Noire, it's a French game.
We did have someone from IGN go and check out the game, but unfortunately none of us did get a chance to go and check it out on Switch.
Yeah, that's out next week, so I'm interested in trying that. I'm kind of amazed at the we talk about this all the time, but like the download sizes of these games are starting to get ridiculous.
They get bigger and bigger. Yeah.
This is like a fifth of your, if you have a 200 gigabyte SD card like I have, this is like a fifth of it.
Yeah.
So,
right. Yeah. So the new stuff that they showed, were the touchscreen controls.
Yep.
So you can actually now pick the, the resolutions to interviews on the touchscreen if you're playing it in handheld mode, which is actually really nice. And like, if you haven't played LA Noir, it looks like an open world game, but really the map is more about like getting around and soaking in that atmosphere of old LA and finding all these landmarks from yesterday. Most of the game is crime scene investigation, you know, talking to people, chasing people. There's some shooting. But the investigation, the interview parts are really cool because you have to call people on their lies. You have to watch people's eyes and their behavior. And I haven't really seen a game like that before.
Or right. since.
Yeah. Or since. Yeah. And like, you know, they prided themselves when it first came out on the kind of facial animations and the, you know, it's got that uncanny valley thing going, but like on their eyes and mm-hmm. expressions. And so now you can actually pick on the screen. You can say, oh, this guy's lying. So they make it much easier and faster, which I'm looking forward to playing this version.
Yeah, yeah. I'm really happy we're seeing some Rockstar support on Switch. I love the games they make, especially this era of games that was sort of like the Bully table tennis LA Noir era.
Man, I wish they'd bring Bully to Switch.
Me too. Yeah. It's such a weird diagonal from their usual sort of big violent open world games. This is still a violent game and it still has some open worldy stuff to it, but it's so cool and so interesting.
Yeah.
And I didn't play this a ton when it first came out, so I'm definitely interested in trying it out again.
Did you know that the Switch version has 7 new fedoras?
Is that true?
Yeah.
Oh, great. Yeah.
7 new fedoras for your policeman to wear.
So, that's it. Yeah. It was a great time for fedoras.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to collect purple hamburgers in order to buy them.
That's right. You gotta get them from the store.
And I was thinking about what's an LA food? It's like, there's nothing.
Hamburgers.
Sorry. LA doesn't have anything.
Cigarettes.
Yeah. Like tacos? Come on. Those are stolen.
Cigarettes. Yeah. LA Noir is a game that I actually missed also. So yep. I'm really looking forward to checking it out on Switch as well. But a game that I actually did play a lot of and I'm still looking forward to playing even more so on Switch and it's coming out this week is Rocket League.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Sonic.
Oh, yeah, no. Unfortunately, Sonic is not my jam.
You're not digging it?
No.
All right, let's talk Rocket League then.
No, but Rocket League, I am incredibly excited for. I've played a ton of Rocket League on PC. I never got too much into the competitive scene. I always just played it casually for fun. But I'm super excited the fact that we're getting like special Nintendo DLC, like we're getting the Metroid car.
That Metroid car is so cool.
I know.
This is the game to bring. If you have a friend with a Switch, bring it to the movies, bring it to Disneyland, bring it anywhere. Like you have to actually wait for something because you can play two player versus right wherever you are, which is awesome. And then, kudos to the developer. They didn't cut any corners. It runs at 60 on the Switch and it's got cross-platform multiplayer. These are the kinds of ports that we need to see more of
I think one of the most fascinating things to come out of this, like sort of Nintendo Switch, Nintendo Renaissance era, is that they do have an underpowered console, but all of these developers are finding these incredible ways to tell these stories at reduced resolutions with like a smaller, you know, smaller storage space and not exactly the best like online infrastructure. They're finding like, I've always been sort of fascinated in like that kind of demake culture or like taking games and making them run on different platforms at different resolutions. Like a lot of really cool, interesting stories are coming out from like a technical level how they're doing this.
But it's a difference, you know, if you remember, we got some of that on the 3DS as well, where you get the Lego games on the 3DS, but the step down isn't that big.
Yeah.
And so, the platform, the hardware is competent enough to run a game like Doom and do it justice, but it also encourages indies with 2D games to actually create them, release them on this platform, and some of them are thriving, so that's great.
How much of this sort of like architecture and stuff is coming from Nintendo themselves, right? Like Nintendo this last generation has proved that they're kind of the masters of this stuff. We were just talking about Xenoblade on 3DS, right?
Yeah.
Yoshi's Woolly World, Hyrule Warriors less so, but like Nintendo has done a really bang up job of like moving some games from one system to a smaller one, or a less powerful one. I could see them supporting a lot of developers and doing the same.
Sounds like we're all looking forward to it, right?
For sure.
It's if you like multiplayer games, like insane kind of like Mario Kart battle mode fun, you have to get this game.
And if you like all
League is so well thought out and controlled so amazingly well.
You liked all the unlockable hats that Zach just made up in LA Noir. There's tons of unlockable hats in this game. You could put a sombrero on the car.
There's upwards of 9 cars in that game.
At least 9 hats and cars. Yep. So that's what it says on the box.
Well, we're going to take a minute here and take a quick break. And joining us after the break is going to be a very, very special guest. So stick around.
This episode is brought to you by Gamefly, the best way to rent or buy your favorite games. It's gotten increasingly difficult to try games before you buy them, but Gamefly lets you take your pick from a library of over 9,000 titles, including the biggest new releases like Super Mario Odyssey, NBA 2K18, Fire Emblem Warriors, and many, many more. Gamefly will ship these games to you, and you can keep them as long as you want. There are no late fees or due dates, and shipping is always free. This breaks down to as little as 54 cents a day. So ask yourself, how many moons can you find in Super Mario Odyssey for 54 cents a day? Oh, and you don't even have to leave the house. The games come right to you. And hey, they rent movies too. Normally, a Gamefly trial lets you only check out one game at a time, but if you head to gamefly.com/voicechat, you can sign up for a free premium 30-day trial that lets you check out 2 games or movies at a time. Try it out today at gamefly.com/voicechat.
Welcome back, everyone, from our short, small break. And we have our guest here joining us today, and we're joined with Mr. Julian...
Egebrecht.
That was pretty good. All right.
That was pretty good.
Yeah. And you are actually the president of Factor 5 and also the vice president of
technology
at Hulu.
Yes, I am. Yeah.
Which is incredible, which we actually just got a Hulu app on Switch today, but we'll maybe talk more about that later. We're way more interested right now in hearing more about the Super Turrican NT Director's Cut that is going to be released on the Super NT, correct? Or it is released?
That is correct. Well, when the Super NT comes out.
Correct. February, I think.
February-ish, yes.
By the way, we're both German, so we both can't pronounce February. We're just going to say that right now, right? Try it.
February.
See? February. We got it.
Oh, that's great. A supercut of that.
But like the Super NT is basically it's a piece of hardware that runs Super NES games at 1080p. It doesn't use software emulation. It's all done in hardware, right?
Right. That's a big difference, I guess, from most of the other attempts that have been done, and even the difference to what Nintendo is doing with their Mini, is that it's a hardware emulator, and it's not even an hardware emulator, but you really have to say it's a simulator. So the hardware chip in there, the FPGA, is really simulating every single circuit that was in a real Super Nintendo.
That's awesome.
And is doing it on a level which is absolutely one-to-one.
So, and that's why the thing costs $190 when it comes out.
It's a pretty reasonable price compared to what the analog guys did last time.
Yeah.
Because if you remember, their NES version of this was a lot more expensive. So I was actually stoked about the price.
So how is it that for decades now we've had emulated Super Nintendo games, and they're always so incredibly challenging to just get right? You would think like, oh, this game is 25 years old, plug it in, download the ROM, get it running, and it's good to go. But forever we've seen hiccups and stuff like Yoshi's Island, anything with some Mode 7 stuff.
Mm-hmm.
How did you guys sort of work around all of those issues?
Well, I wasn't involved too much, but I'm reasonably well on top of the tech in the device. The trick is that you really need to simulate each and every circuit which is in the hardware at the same time and with the same time. And you can do that in these FPGA simulations, but you cannot do that, or it's practically impossible with current computing power, in pure software, which would be a typical emulator running on an ARM chip or an Intel chip. And with that, the problem is that you always have differences in timing, and something always goes wrong, because we developers back then squeezed out every little bit out of the Super Nintendo and the early consoles at the time. I mean, nowadays, you can simulate a little bit easier because the systems are so complex you can't really go down to the metal anymore. But back then we did. So we figured out and sometimes accidentally tripped the weirdest timings in those boxes. Mm. And that's what then hits you when you try to emulate in software.
So did you know the analog guys? Like the whole connection. So analog makes this box. You guys made this game Super Turrican. I remember, you know, when we first met, I think you guys were working on Rogue Squadron actually.
Probably.
And I visited you office up in Marin County near Skywalker Ranch up there, and was amazed at what you guys were doing with the N64. Then went back and played Super Turrican, and I was like, oh, okay, well, these guys clearly know their tech. You guys were squeezing out a lot, but there's a story behind that game, and you guys actually had to, I don't want to say dumb it down, but you had to pare it down for the Super NES.
We had to cut it down. It was funny. We actually worked on Super Turrican, actually at one of my partners, in his childhood bedroom still, in 1992, in Cologne, Germany. So that was before we hooked up with LucasArts and started working with them, and later on Lucasfilm. But yeah, so we worked in his bedroom, and we worked and worked and worked. And at some point, our publisher at the time says, well, we would like to have the whole thing in 4 megabits. And we always thought, ah, come on, they will never insist on that. Because at the time, if you looked at the Konami titles, if you looked at Nintendo first party, but even most of the third party titles, I mean, I think Street Fighter 2 was just around the corner, and that was 16 megabits. So we thought, ah, come on, we will get an 8 megabit.
And yours is, if you're not familiar with the games, right, they're side-scrolling Contra-like games,
yeah,
right,
yeah,
with
exactly.
Actual levels. So it's not like Street Fighter, which has a pretty contained stage,
yeah. So 4 megabits were pretty horrible. and so we were optimistic, youthful and optimistic. And I think we stopped developing the game only at the point when we ran out of money, which is the most likely scenario. It's a little bit foggy 30 years on. We sat there, and it was 6 megabits at the time. So it was too much. And so the problem with it really was that we then went on, found publishers for the different territories. But the U.S. one, which was almost, I think nowadays, completely unknown company called Sega, they actually insisted on the 4 megabits. We had for Japan, we had Hudson Soft. And Hudson Soft actually was totally gung-ho with 8. Huh. But didn't help because, of course, the U.S. market was the most important one.
Oh, wow.
So they enforced it with the company which was financing the whole thing for us. They enforced the 4 megabits, and we sat there and then spent the miserable few weeks before Christmas chopping our own game down. And
did you keep? Did you have an original version that was done and then you chopped, or like what is this thing?
What we have here, I found on a diskette, 3.5-inch floppy, as we called them back then, actually in the early 2000s, I believe, and I found it at home, and it basically said Super Turrican 6M MBit, and was wow, we kept that because I thought it was lost. I thought that back then we were scrambling so much that the whole thing would be gone. But no, lo and behold, we hooked up a disk drive to a PC, which we still had around in the archive at Factor 5. And there it was. And since then, I had it essentially on my hard drive and didn't know what to do with it yet, because we were always looking for some special occasion. And we thought we had that finally when Nintendo launched the Virtual Console back then on the Wii. And we talked to NOA at the time and basically said, hey, can we have Super Turrican, Super Turrican 2, and then from the Sega side, Mega Turrican on the Genesis on Virtual Console? And they said, yeah, absolutely. Why not? And then I pitched the idea of why don't we do something special? We bundle somebody who buys all three games or the two Super Nintendo titles gets as a bonus the director's cut, the original version. And NOA loved the idea, but then Nintendo Japan stepped in, because at the time the policy was absolutely strictly that only titles could be released on Virtual Console which were released exactly like that in the marketplace before. And apparently it came from Iwata-san personally. So we pleaded and we begged and everything, but at the end of the day, they didn't want to budge. So opportunity lost. The games still, the original games came out on Virtual Console.
Was that an idea of just like the labeling of what it was? Because I know we saw like sort of like original Bomberman games under the WiiWare label. Like, was it just calling it a virtual console?
I mean,
like,
maybe they were worried that these games hadn't gone through QA.
That is something. I mean, of course, and we found some anomalies with which we would have been bounced out, I believe, because some of the code wasn't quite that good in terms of the sound chip. But nevertheless, there was no reason why they couldn't have published it. It was simply a policy thing. And again, opportunity lost. Then we once again were basically focusing more on current things. And then Analog came around. Chris Tabor, the head of Analog, actually contacted me, when was that, 6 years ago, when they did their Neo Geo, their gorgeous Neo Geo variants with made out of wood,
right?
Which was the first thing they did, even before their NES clone. And he contacted me and said, I've read about this, because I think I had talked about it in interviews, or we had it on the webpage, actually, that it existed. And can't we make a cartridge out of it? Mm-hmm. And I wasn't too hot about the cartridge idea, because that's so hardcore. I mean, how many people really still have the units around for that, the old units? So we lost contact.
We should say that Super NT has a cartridge slot.
Of course, yes.
But the game is actually pre-installed.
The game is pre-installed, and not only Super Turrican Director's Cut is pre-installed, also Super Turrican 2 is pre-installed. Okay. We threw that in, and nice. That's unchanged. That's the original version as it came out back then. But yeah, those are the two pre-installed games. Everything else you have to bring yourself, but of course you have a system at that moment, and you can go to any flea market.
You were
going to
say Funko Land just now, weren't you?
I do like that aspect of it, though, because you guys are effectively like nudging people to go out and start collecting Super Nintendo cartridges.
We are, and that's actually the passion which Chris from Analog really and the whole gang at Analog really wants to express, is the we don't only want to preserve and not even preserve perfectly, as Nintendo does it, unfortunately, the top 20 games of the system, but we want to preserve the system and everything that entailed it. Also the experience that you actually have a cartridge and you plug the cartridge
in.
Right. So that's something they feel extremely strongly about.
But Factor 5 doesn't exist anymore, right?
Well, it does exist. The company exists in
it's a Phantom Menace. It's out there somewhere.
It's out there. It's a legal entity and it exists in email addresses. You can email me still at julian@factor5.com.
I heard there's a Twitter account for Factor 5. Is that true?
There's a Twitter account. Okay. Yeah.
But it's like, how did you guys find to each other? Like, how did you find the Analog guys making the machine?
Chris actually contacted me earlier this year again, Chris Tabor from Analog, and said, well, you can probably imagine what we're doing, knowing what Nintendo, of course, was working on.
Yeah.
And I had finally seen one of their consoles when actually my son gave me for my birthday last year the original, their NES clone, and even the Famicom, the gorgeous red Famicom version of that, the Japanese version of it, and I loved it, played all of my NES cards on it from my collection, so I knew that these guys would be in for quality. That was for me the most important thing. I mean, we certainly have been contacted many times over by some of these, shall we say, not quite so official collection boxes, which are floating around on the net in a more or less legal or illegal fashion. And we always turned them down, or basically just ignored the requests. But when Chris recontacted me about the whole thing, I was completely gung-ho, because that was the perfect opportunity.
And you guys, I mean, if you go back in the NVC archives, I'm sure you can find our previous episode with Julian from 290 years ago, where you talk a little bit about the history of Factor 5, but you guys were kind of, you came from the demo programming scene.
Yeah.
If we can call it euphemistically that.
The demo programming scene, right. Also, I think highly invested in making really, really nice intros for games that were being cracked to be pirated easily.
The statute of limitations, are you safe? Like, I'm not going to drag you out of this
room now. I think I'm pretty good.
Yeah, so dancing rainbows and techno music.
That is true, yeah.
But you brought up Factor 5. Are we going to see this company again?
Yeah, we're very actively exploring that. I mean, we all have our day jobs currently at Hulu, obviously, because the old gang. Lots of people have been asking. So what are these? What are the folks doing? And where did they spread out? Well, we didn't spread out. We stayed together all of those years.
Still the same bedroom with a teddy bear on the pillows. And
obviously, we moved over to Marin County at some point. But no, I mean the company in Cologne still exists. We are still up in Marin, and actually not very far from Skywalker Ranch. So not all that much has changed. We're working on different stuff.
But
currently.
You did under the name Touch Factory. You did some mobile stuff.
We did some mobile stuff. Yeah, we did Touch Fish, which was a free-to-play mobile pet game. So we did that, and we did lots and lots and lots of the video apps that you guys have been using on many, many systems over the years. We did some of the early Netflix versions for the Nintendo systems and others.
Where's our Netflix?
I cannot comment on any Netflix.
But you can come on Hulu, which literally launched this morning, kind of like surprisingly in Nintendo's press release. They were like, oh, Hulu. I was like reading all the games and I was like, Hulu, is that like a weird Match 3 puzzle indie game? And I was like, oh no, that's the video streaming service.
Yes, yeah.
So why now? Why today? Why not at launch, I guess? Like,
why not at launch? That was a political decision, by Nintendo to a certain degree, but also a technical one, because they really wanted to focus on, the game side of things on the one hand. And secondly, really only were able to provide the basic technical functionality that you needed to make the greatest games, on the new console. So, one of the things, which was missing until recently, was one tiny little bit of, encryption, that, most of the, professional, video services unfortunately need. Once that was unblocked for us, it was, not a problem to get the whole thing going. We had the streaming actually and most of the tech, we had done, quite a while ago. It was really,
so is the a codec just like the, I mean, there's an Apple TV issue with supplying, 4K content for some applications. Is that the same kind of story with this machine?
Oh, no, not at all. It's completely different. Okay. No, I mean, this is on the very, basic HDMI, connector, level, because there are certain things which games don't need necessarily. Okay. But which, a service like Hulu or also, I assume, Netflix, and Amazon, needs just in terms of digital rights protection. And, that was, while it was on the hardware, it was always in the hardware of the Switch. That simply wasn't enabled yet.
And that's, you know, 1080p, obviously. There were rumors before this machine launched that it could do pass-through 4K for video streaming. You guys tinker with that at all?
No, we didn't tinker at all with anything like that. I mean, for us, it was always very obvious and pretty straightforward that you have the 720p when you're in undocked mode, and in docked, you've got 1080p.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, that's cool. But Factor 5. So it still floats out there.
Yes.
I was just watching our team play Star Wars Battlefront.
Right.
And then
I saw it out in the lobby.
Yeah. And I look at it and it looks beautiful. Obviously, you guys created space combat the way we imagined it would look after watching the movies, right? Like they really wasn't before Rogue Squadron. There wasn't a game that looked like that. And when you first showed us Rogue Leader, I'm like, oh my God, that's what Star Wars looks like. That's what the Death Star trench run looks like.
No, as like a quick aside, I mean, I'm very lucky at this job. I get to interview a lot of people who work on the games that are coming out every single day. It's not often I get to meet somebody that like legitimately influenced the games I was playing all through college. The Rogue games were like, as a huge Star Wars fan, the Rogue games were incredibly important to me. So thank you for making those. But also they were sort of like these amazing showcases of technology. I think that you guys were capable of pulling off stuff that we didn't know was even possible on GameCube. And in many ways also sort of changing the conversation that the GameCube was underpowered and that it would only do cartoony children's graphics.
You could see, I mean, at the time we saw games like Racer, for example, Episode 1 Racer. And before that, you know, we saw Shadows of the Empire. That definitely was a difference when we looked at your game. But so now here we are today. I'm watching Battlefront Space Combat. I'm like, oh man, that brings back memories of Rogue Leader. And then I look at this machine and there's no Star Wars game on it.
I know. Oh, isn't that a shame?
Yeah.
I think the same.
what about that unreleased game you guys did?
Rogue Squadron Wii. Yeah. Well, shall we just say it's something which, oh yeah, right. You dug out the footage which we released at some point. Mm-hmm. It's definitely something we, in some way, shape or form, which should really come out of the archives. And, I mean, all of the things that I think prevented that, back in 2009 when we finished the game, should be out of the way nowadays. So I think it's just about the willingness of probably us spending some time on it, Disney Lucasfilm playing along with it, and then probably EA must be a little bit in the mix, but we'll see about that.
Yeah, I was going to say, because like obviously Lucas Games, the company that released all these games.
Yeah, LucasArts.
LucasArts, sorry.
The last one was LucasArts. I'm wearing a Maniac Mansion.
Nice.
Hell yeah.
Here. So I played Lucasfilm games back in the day, like Eidolon and Rescue and Fractalus
and Maniac Mansion. Nice. Yeah, this is authentic, back from '86. I'm mostly stoked that I can still wear it.
This rogue game for Nintendo Wii was completed. Effectively, right?
Effectively, but it was completed.
It was done.
It went through Nintendo QA. It went through Lucas did extensive QA. We did QA, so it was done. Yeah, it was
and
ready
so
to
I,
be released.
I almost hate to bring this up, but like EA just canceled the new Visceral Star Wars game. You know, the sort of the Amy Hennig's third person sort of Uncharted meets Star Wars game. That studio got gutted and moved around. What's it like being in a room when a Star Wars game get canceled? I mean. Not to evoke such miserable memories, but
you're twisting the knife, man.
I mean, like, it's not often I get to sit down with someone who's
no, that's true.
No,
I mean, you probably remind me of the worst period of my
I tend to do that with people.
Professional, if not personal life, so thank you very much.
Excellent. Nice to meet you. Thanks for coming to do our show.
It was a huge blow, and to this day, I mean, we had a few team members, or a lot of the team members actually either went on then and are not in games anymore, basically have retired, and that sometimes due to illness. And a lot of them are saying it's the best work which we ever did. And I'm personally convinced, and everybody who did get a chance to play the game is of the opinion that it's probably the best game we ever made. It's double hard in that respect.
So your answer is that it was so difficult and miserable that some people on the team actually retired from video games forever.
Yes. Yeah. Flat out. I mean, I personally wasn't ready to jump into AAA or basically even contemplate. I mean, I would still say it would be a hard road back to AAA, and I really wouldn't know if we would be prepared to do that again. But I was personally for a year or two was completely out of it. We were happy doing Netflix and doing Amazon and doing Hulu and all of these things, that we did, because you could focus on the tech. The companies were large enough that you didn't have to worry about any politics whatsoever. And we were more or less, completely switched off from the creative process. And that was needed because it's really heartbreaking.
So the game was a best of, right? It had the entire last game.
It was the original vision that we had for the ultimate Star Wars game that we always wanted to do. But then Rogue Leader, of course, on Rogue Squadron, for the N64, Skywalker Ranch at the time didn't want to have any tie-ins with the movies directly. So we were in the classic universe, but we had to come up with an original storyline. Then when Rogue Squadron was so successful, then luckily enough, they allowed that we could actually tie directly into bits from the movies straight up, and that then was Rogue Leader, but we only had 9 months, right, due to the launch title. So what was missing in Rogue Leader and what should have been in there was really then in the third Rogue game, which was Rebel Strike, but there was also a lot of filler content and ill-conceived decisions by the director, which happened to be me. So I take full responsibility for
this. Is all pre-Disney. This is pre-Disney. Expanded universe canon, which I imagine it's even more. I mean, one of the things I was reading in Kotaku's breakdown of the Visceral story was that if you want to get a character's like belt approved, it's got to go through the story group. It's got to go through all this stuff. Yeah, you guys have to experience any stuff like that? Or?
Oh, of course. It was always like that. No, I mean, when LucasArts basically gave us back then the keys to the kingdom that we could work on Star Wars, it was, especially in the beginning, it was painful going back and forth with Lucasfilm licensing because, yes, of course, they had, even back then, complete control over every single detail, just like Disney's Lucasfilm has nowadays. And it was painful, but it really paid off that our games, especially after the first Rogue, was so successful and people acknowledged the fact that we deeply, deeply cared about Star Wars. And thus, We didn't make any mistakes. I mean, every single thing that we ever ran by licensing back then, they immediately approved because we had a certain knack and love. First of all, love for the franchise. So we would have never done anything that wouldn't have fit the franchise, but also a certain talent to actually, if you do variations on it, then at least it needs to feel like Star Wars. And I think we had a pretty unique talent in that respect, which probably was pure German obsessiveness.
Didn't you have one of your rogue games had a unlockable car that you could drive through space?
No, practically every single Factor 5 game, I believe, since the 3D era had the same unlockable car.
I just wanted to
point
out.
Was that your programmer's car?
Yeah. No, one of our sound and video post-production guys, Rudy. Rudolf Stemba, his Buick, 68 Buick.
Yeah, and so this is what I love because you guys were so perfectly detail-oriented. I still retain that I think you've done probably the best Battle of Hoth that we've ever seen in a game. Oh, yeah. And you are talking about how specific you were and how on the books you were.
No, you have never. We did create the best Battle of Hoth by a long shot ever in a game, and nobody has ever played it except for my kids and a few testers at LucasArts because actually in Rogue we merged together the Rogue Leader Battle of Hoth and the one the level which was actually on the ground partially in the clouds in Rebel Strike, completely remixed the whole thing and then put our next generation lighting engine and everything on there. And in low res, the whole thing doesn't look, or to this day, if you fire up the debug Wii that I have with the game, it doesn't look all that different from the newest Battlefront. Because we had global illumination pulled off on the Wii and a lot of crazy things.
Just low res.
Just low res, yeah.
Which used to be high res back then.
Yeah. No. Even back then. I mean, we're talking 2009 here. But yeah, people would have been absolutely, utterly blown away.
I want to play this so bad. Oh,
yeah, and it is absolutely, I would say, the best Battle of Hoth ever done.
We got to do it. Well, next time you come on the show, when you're a debug unit.
Yeah, we got to do a Let's Play. Exactly.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
And you get you on expert mode out. So, that'd be awesome.
Yeah.
That's cool. But, I mean, you guys have a bigger back catalog than that. Obviously, you've got the Turrican games. Mm-hmm. You worked on India as well, right?
Yeah, we did. That was our first collaboration, actually, with LucasArts, was Indiana Jones' Greatest Adventures for the Super Nintendo, mm-hmm. Which was on the Virtual Console, actually. I was stoked about that. It was great that they worked that out. And then later on, we did an extremely painful reinvention port of the PC, Indiana Jones, and the Infernal Machine, which was fundamentally a Tomb Raider clone.
Yeah.
And we actually brought that to the N64, and we almost bit off more than we could swallow in that case. It was really, really tough to do it, but it was fun because we completely reinvented the mechanics of the game. Lucas allowed us to basically say we essentially use the level design and the characters and everything and the graphics as they are in the story, but we completely redid controls and everything to make it more like Ocarina of Time. That was
one of the more ambitious N64 games. And before you joined us today, we were talking about the new Doom, the port of Doom, mm-hmm. and L.A. Noire and Rocket League, all very ambitious games performing on underperforming hardware effectively. When you port a game like that, what are some of the first things that die, basically? What are the first things that have to sort of hit the cutting room floor?
It's less about the cutting room floor. It's about the, you look, at the original, and we've done quite a few ports. We did R-Type, for example, back then the arcade game, port, to a home computer, which is even more painful than something like this. And, the first thing is you find the essence, and what you really have to look in a port at, what is the essence of what you're playing and what you're looking at. And then you very quickly find things that the normal person probably would never see if you tone it down a little bit here or if you cut a little bit there. And then you just start cutting out certain things. And in other areas, you suddenly find stuff where you can improve on it. I mean, back on Indie, for example, the PC version didn't have real-time lighting. And our N64 microcode engine actually could do that, so we just switched it on. So we suddenly had real-time light and shadows in a game which was never built for that. On the other hand, of course, the textures got somewhat chopped down.
Right.
But if you're clever about it, then you can do, you get down to the spirit of the port. Somebody just, I think on some internet forum, actually, spoke about the fact that they always appreciated the Factor 5 ports, because we also did, for example, Contra 3, The Alien Wars, which was the Super Nintendo Contra, for the Game Boy. And of course you would say this is crazy. But if you play it, it very much feels like the same thing. And of course it's got less sprites and everything. The Game Boy was vastly more primitive, but you actually acknowledge it's Contra 3. Whereas if you play, Street Fighter 2, for example, they attempted a port of that. Mm-hmm. It's just god awful. And that's because they didn't get the spirit of the game right and the feel of the game.
Mortal Kombat Advance historically is like one of the worst ports in video game history. And I think that's completely, sort of like leans in exactly what you're saying there.
And for us, I mean, for us, ports always were on every single port that we did, was more or less a little bit of an exercise, almost like playing an instrument, because we mostly did original games, of course. But the ports were a fun way of, oh, let's look at some other creator's creation and let's try to understand the spirit behind it. I mean, I had an extreme kick doing an official port of Contra 3 because I loved that game, of course.
You guys also did Animaniacs.
Right? We did Animaniacs, which came from the Genesis, actually. Yeah. That was a Genesis game, and we ported that. That was our Konami. I'm sorry. And we almost did Castlevania. We wanted to do Castlevania, and then Konami Osaka, I believe, shut that down because they wanted to do something themselves, and I don't think they ever did.
No offense, but you're an old Nintendo head, right? You've grown up with Nintendo machines before that, Amiga, obviously.
Yeah.
You guys, whenever I met the team, there was this real passion for figuring out how to get the most out of these machines, the N64 and the GameCube. And like, there was even a phase where you guys worked very closely with Nintendo on, you know, video compression and sound compression, all that kind of stuff, getting really unprecedented MIDI music out of the machines as well. Do you ever miss it? You guys even pitched like Kid Icarus and Pilot Wings to Nintendo. Like, do you miss that relationship?
I cannot comment on that.
Yeah. All right. But we've seen art floating around the internet. But like, do you miss working closely with Nintendo?
I still can't comment on
that. Oh, you can? All right.
No, I won't. But the Nintendo relationship, of course. Look, it's the same people still. I was just in Kyoto, actually, at Nintendo a few weeks ago. And in a way, the same thing. When I'm up in Seattle, we oftentimes meet, and some of those guys, and we go back, oh God, 25 years by now. Because, I mean, Nintendo is also a company which loses very few people. On the other hand, we always stuck together as a team, in whatever incarnation, we were around. So you actually just built this long, 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 long relationship. And I think that's partially probably the reason why Hulu is the first streaming service in terms of launch, simply because as a side effect of having known these companies, and the same goes for Sony, by the way, because we were also part of Mark Cerny's team back on the PS3 launch. Let's not forget about that. We always get access pretty early, even nowadays. Of course, we don't need it quite as early these days as game guys do, because it's a little bit easier to get the streaming service up and running. But nevertheless, that relationship is still there.
Absolutely. Is that how we saw some of the sort of PSVR stuff that worked its way into the Hulu app?
The Hulu, all of the Hulu VR apps, anything in that field is actually being done in Marin.
Oh, cool. You could watch Hulu on a virtual beach, basically, or a movie theater or stuff like that. Yeah. And none of the other streaming services were doing that. So that's interesting that you can bring that kind of stuff to the table.
No, and it's a lot of fun. Same thing. We talked to Sony very early on. I know the guys who actually did a lot of the R&D behind the PSVR headset back from the day. We just said, can we play around with it? And they said, why your streaming service? And we still said, yeah, but there might be something interesting there. So
you already, you said, I'm not sure if I'm ready to jump into AAA or if you ever want to go back into it. But if you had a dream project and you wanted to pursue, like, if you said, all right, I'm going to get the gang back together, we'll get the band back together, we're going to make a game for Twitch or any console, what would you go after?
I mean, my immediate dream would be actually to do to first port basically what we had on Rogue Squadron Wii to the Switch, because the Switch in terms of input characteristics is pretty much the only console which would be Rogue Squadron Wii actually supported every single input device. So in spirit, it was very comparable to what Nintendo did with Mario Odyssey, or even more so Mario Kart, actually. It's probably, we took a big inspiration from Mario Kart, which even at the time you could play with a hardcore controller, with a GameCube controller.
But it had motion controls for the lightsabers. And it had, you could play it in an alternate
mode. For the lightsabers, the whole subsection with the lightsaber dueling, you could only play with a motion plus, which was the gyro, because we needed one-to-one mapping. And we actually expanded greatly in terms of the lightsaber dueling on what Wii Sports Resort did, because they did relatively simple blocking and everything. We had force powers in there, and we had more levels of blocking, so it was a lot more sophisticated than that. And so the Switch would be the only console really currently in terms of input characteristics where you could port the game to. And then you would really want to get the gang together and probably contact, I mean, they're all around, our lead artists who did all of the, who did the look oh so unbelievably right, and basically spent half his time at Skywalker Ranch, designing for George, on the movies actually, and the other half of the day, drawing the textures, for us, is now at Pixar. So, but it's only a stone throw away. So right. I'm sure we could get these guys together and actually do a really nice up-res version. The models, still hold up.
Yeah.
The highest
textures, I mean, it was designed for 480p, right?
Exactly. No. So, it was, it's okay in 1080p. The models still hold up because, our highest resolution model actually of the X-Wing, which we did use, in the Wii version finally, because we had enough memory for it. If you got really close with a camera, that was, I believe almost 30,000 polygons.
That's in that single shit. Is it seen in that cutscene? You guys recreated
yes,
that?
Yes, when the camera,
we saw that earlier.
That isn't the final, Wii version, which we did. The final Wii version, the models hold up so well that you can really drive your camera into the cockpit, pretty much. I don't think that that on those models you would see much of a difference compared to what EA created later on.
That surprises a lot of people, myself included, when they when you see video games from Nintendo platforms get ripped through emulation software. I think Dolphin's one of the ones that people use on high-end PCs.
Right.
When you go in and actually see that a lot of the character models and textures go into it looking fantastic, and then the resolution that it, like say something like the Wii or the 3DS spits out at the end kind of blurs that a little bit, but there's a really beautiful game underneath all.
I think you always have that a little bit. You had it in 480p, and you certainly have it with the I mean, the 3DS had certain rendering characteristics which were somewhere in between I'd say a PlayStation 2, and I mean, it could do powerful shaders, but on the same level, it didn't really sample the individual pixels at a very nice quality.
Sure.
And with that, you get exactly what you describe, which is a little bit gets lost. On the other hand, I was always amazed what the 3DS for what the chip was able to do in there.
Oh yeah.
So we never worked on it, but we had it. Well, we actually did. We did a couple of streaming services on it. So
cool.
We should take a quick vote. Who's who votes yes for releasing Rogue Squadron on the Switch?
Oh, 100,000%.
Yeah, I'm for it. Yeah. Yes. Anybody watching maybe want to see this? Yeah,
okay. Yeah.
So,
I mean,
we decided, Julian.
Thank you.
I don't know where all that falls in like the legal minefield of like Disney and Star Wars and Lucas and the games that they're working on.
Legal minefield is putting it mildly.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. No, I mean, the whole thing, how the whole thing fell apart in 2009 definitely rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. At the end of the day, it probably would have needed a little bit of courage from somebody to step up on that level, but it's really hard to get that back to life again. We're certainly up for it, and anything which happened back then has been resolved a long time ago. Mm-hmm. So the time would be right for it. The big question is anybody at Disney/Lucasfilm and or EA, if they have to be involved, up for the whole thing? But you never know. You never should say never.
Well, when you're ready, let us know which congressman to write to, and we'll ask our fans.
I can give you phone numbers
to help.
Oh. Congresswoman Kathleen Kennedy.
Yeah, write to Kathleen Kennedy. Exactly.
Oh, no. Well, we only have a few minutes left here of the show, but before we wrap things up, we did want to go over the news here. So it looks like the other day was just the last day of the Miiverse. It is officially over, unfortunately. So hopefully you guys had fun checking in. If you did check in, I know that a couple of my friends were on there making some crazy stuff happen. Brian, did you get a chance to?
Yeah, I have such fond memories of Miiverse. I think it meant a different thing to so many different people, which was cool about it. For some people, it was this awesome art gallery.
Yeah.
Right? For others, it was easily and quickly accessible game help. You could get stuck in something and pull up a community of people. For others, it was a source of memes, such as why doesn't Metroid crawl, you know? which Metroid was people playing Metroid for the first time and not knowing how Samus fit into small barriers. Because I didn't know if you just go left at the beginning of Metroid, you become a ball and it's all good.
And that Samus's name is not there.
Yeah, and I was reading about the sort of the last few hours of Miiverse. I think there's something fascinating when online community closes its doors at the very end. And there, I remember there was like reading about like Halo, the original Halo going offline and people sort of like creating a server for it and then just staying in it for as long as possible, like because they don't want to say goodbye. And there's something beautiful and tragic about that.
That lasted like weeks or months.
Very,
right?
Very long time. And I think there was like some guy had like a power out in his house or something, and then the Halo Online was over.
Oh no.
Yeah, that stuff is so interesting to me. So I really hope, like most things that we say goodbye to in Nintendo Land, I hope it's because they're ushering in a successor at some point. You know, I would like to see something like Miiverse on Switch that sort of collates all of the fun things and art and game help and community that successfully worked there.
There's some stuff like if you go into Splatoon 2, for example.
The community, absolutely. I mean, I think some of the spirit, you're absolutely right, is in the marketplace in the Splatoon game.
Yeah.
I mean, that's definitely inspired by it. I think if there was one thing which if they do it in the future, it should not be the first thing that gets loaded up when you switch on the system. I think that was a big problem. And one of the things which really got me stoked was when I had the first experience with the OS of the Switch, because we were so skeptical. Would they have a slow, long loading operating system again? And Nintendo had promised us that no, when we saw that as a big mistake and we really want to make it snappy this time. So when I experienced it the first time, I was in heaven. I was like, yeah, give me rather less features, but make it snappy, make it immediately accessible. But from there, you could easily then go into something like Miiverse as your hub. Just don't make it the first screen.
Yeah, I agree.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I'm sad to see it go. I really do hope that we get something like that on Switch. It would be nice to have like a community-driven type place where we could all congregate and help each other.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But along that, we also have some new Fire Emblem Warriors content. It's actually free, and it's coming out November 16th. I believe it's a new character. So, definitely check that out if you're into Fire Emblem Warriors. But more importantly, we do also have a bunch of new games that are coming out this week alongside of what we just mentioned, Doom. But
Brian played them all?
Yes, Brian, I know, played a bunch. You actually gave me a code for one of them, Cat Quest.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you guys made that up. I
just want to go on the record right now. When Brian gave me this code, I sort of like, I don't know, I made fun of the game's name. I didn't take it seriously. But then I went home and I actually played the game and played it for like 5 hours straight.
Yeah,
I really enjoyed it. Yeah,
it's really
fun. Super good.
I think I was like 5% hazing you, but 95% like, hey, I think this is going to be a cool game.
Yeah.
So yeah, I try to stay on top of indie stuff and I was like, maybe I'll pass the torch a little bit.
That's awesome. That.
So yeah, Cat Quest, it's a sort of like open world-ish RPG. I believe it was an iOS game. It was also on Steam, and it's really fun, very hack and slashy. It's very like arcade RPG.
It's simple but addictive.
Yeah. Exactly. Like, sometimes I just need like a mindless game to play on my Switch while I'm watching a TV show, and like grinding and leveling up in this game is really fun. The dungeons are really fun. It's really cool.
Yeah, if you go in with like your expectations tempered, you know, and if you like grinding for gear and leveling up and all that stuff, you'll probably enjoy this game. So I mean,
nice.
Definitely think about getting it. Also, Snipperclips Plus is another game that's coming out this week, and they've officially finally added pro controller support. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that I thought and I felt pretty seriously about was missing from Snipperclips. I don't like it when Nintendo kind of forces us to do things against our will, like, you know, use Joy-Cons or use motion controls.
I'm not commenting on that. having worked on Lair.
Not
too big of a fan of that. Too soon? Reference.
Hey, that was eventually fixed.
Too
right?
soon.
A couple years
that,
late.
That was eventually, no, what always was fixed was eventually released.
Ah.
there is a nasty backstory to that one.
All right. But just kind of quickly going over some more games. We've got Ben 10. That's also coming out this week as well. But then starting early next week, Rime, November 14th. L.A. Noire, November 14th. All of these games are coming out on the 14th. Batman, the Telltale series, Rocket League, Little Do, and Pinball FX. So we've got a lot of stuff coming out in the next week. Mm-hmm. And, you know, last week we just had a huge dump of games as well. So it's just continuing to flow.
Not like we're busy with Mario Odyssey still.
Yeah.
Mario Odyssey, and you should spend your time watching TV on Hulu.
That's
definitely.
Right. Yeah.
I know. Mario Odyssey and The Handmaid's Tale. Perfect.
Handmaid's Tale.
I haven't seen it. I hear only good things about that.
It's fantastic. Yeah. Really, really proud of the Emmy as well.
If you marathon through the whole season in one day, you can actually unlock her outfit in Mario Odyssey.
That is so terrible.
Yeah. Really, it's a lie. Don't believe that. Don't write into me. I'm lying. It's fake.
So yeah, every week we answer a question from you, the listeners. So this question, and also our email is nvc@ign.com. So if you have a question, we'd love to hear from you. You can also just leave a comment, wherever we accept comments. This week's question comes from William Ramos. He asks, so now that we've all played Mario Odyssey a bit more extensively and now that the honeymoon phase is starting to wane, how do you feel about it, and where does this rank with the rest of the other Mario platformers, 3D platformers only, or overall?
Oh man, that's a great question. I feel like we could fold this a lot into the spoiler cast we do on Mario Odyssey, which is coming.
Yeah.
I keep going back and forth on this being like my favorite 3D Mario game ever made, while also simultaneously missing some of the direction that a game like 64 had, for example.
Yeah.
I feel like it's almost a little too, it feels like being in a big department store sometimes and not really knowing which aisle you need to go shopping in and wanting a bunch of things, but not knowing where to go. Whereas Mario 64 is sort of just like, get to the top and you're like, oh, okay, I can do that. And while you're there, you can collect coins and other stuff. So,
I felt it was, I mean, Mario 64 was actually not linear, right? It had all these paintings you could jump into, but I felt like it kind of funneled you a little bit more. Whereas like Odyssey, once you get to this part and you know, you're done with the main quest, you have all these levels unlocked, you're just like, oh my God, what am I going to do next? And so you spend a little time here, a little time there, then you run into an impossible challenge. I have to say, for me, the honeymoon period is not over. I'm just under 600 moons. I feel like I'm going to keep on playing. I just flew to LA, brought this thing with me, did a couple of moons in the airplane and on the way back. It's a battery hog though.
I can second that. Yeah. I'm not even as deeply into it as you. I'm in, I think in the 300 moons or something, but it's, the only criticism that I would level, and it really was gorgeous, and I still prefer 64, but I think that's more for the unbelievable shock of what they did back then.
Yep.
Never underestimate that. That ever. Is not repeatable.
No. That ushered in a new dimension of gaming.
Right.
Like, we were just jumping in that tree in the beginning, just going like,
just going mad. But I had a little bit of that feeling, I have to say, and none of the interim ones, even Galaxy, as brilliant as it was, didn't have that immediate joy of the controls, which they brought back with this one. And I spent in that first area actually probably, about as much time as I did back then on 64. Playing around with the controls, and I was blown away because all of the previous, especially 3D World, I just took the control for granted and just played the game. Whereas here, I purely saw the controls and the brilliance of it and all of the different moves as a game in itself, just encountering them by themselves. So
I think that's the level that Cappy brings into it, right? This sort of just like everything has almost felt like an evolution of Mario 64, which in itself was an evolution of the moveset that Mario had in Mario vs. Donkey Kong, which weirdly enough is the first time he ever went to a city that was Donkey Kong themed. So you're welcome, New Donk City. But now with Cappy, I mean, it took me about 10 hours into the game to figure out that hat throw into the hat dive into the jump off of the hat into second hat throw, and you can cover football fields doing that, and that is kind of a game changer for a lot of things, and even like sort of the Koopa races, right? And adding that level of verticality and distance that you can throw in there makes them so much fun to play and so much fun to watch.
What a perfect learning curve. I mean, it's you don't know the hat jump move in the beginning, and you know you can be 300 moons in,
mm-hmm.
be having fun with that game, but you don't know how to execute this every time.
And then you discover it and you do it and you realize, oh my God, there are all these challenges centered around that very move. And by the end of the game, they expect you to do stuff, right? Like once you're on the redacted or you go to the redacted level, you have to do that stuff.
Yeah.
And then they play perfectly to that nostalgia of Mario 64, Sunshine, you know, like that, the 3D heydays for Mario. Yeah, I love that game. I'm going to keep on playing it.
It's a brilliant game.
I am saying in some challenges, I'm flipping the game off a little bit.
God,
there are some really tough ones that, again, we'll get into in the spoiler cast.
Well, like Zach Ryan was texting me last night, and he was like, you know, I think this might be my game of the year. And when I had left him at the office that day, he was screaming at his Switch.
Yeah.
And I think that's amazing because it does give you that weird abusive relationship of like, this is pushing back so hard and it's really challenging you. But when you get that moon, it's victory. Everything's great.
Victory. It truly feels so unbelievably good. Yeah. I'm torn between, I mean, my game of the year clearly is either that or Zelda.
Yeah.
And I'm still extremely torn. I mean, I'm still unbelievably impressed just how open world they actually made Zelda and how little imposed, because that would be my one single criticism on Mario, that it feels that first campaign, playthrough of the main story feels a tad too linear compared to 64 back then. 64 has a strangely more open feeling.
Yep.
And I think Zelda nailed that a little bit more, that they gave even more freedom in the beginning. But again, I mean, we're talking.
Well, it's granular at that
nuance
point.
Nuance between two amazing games.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's
yeah. You know, there's a lot to unpack there. We'll be talking about Mario Odyssey for years. So
absolutely. And we do definitely have a spoiler cast coming up. So definitely make sure you stick around for that. I'm sure that's going to be happening in the next few days very, very soon. But thank you very much, Julian, for joining us. It was awesome.
Always
having
a pleasure.
You here. Please come back very soon. Hopefully with that Wii Dev Kit and Gothic Rogue.
We shall see about that.
Yeah. Yes. That's going to be it for episode 381 of Nintendo Voice Chat. Thank you all for joining us, and always remember to come back next week. And definitely, if you have any questions, email us at the email. And goodbye.
See you soon.
Hi, I'm Alexis Ohanian. You may know me as one of the co-founders of Reddit, but more recently, a large part of my identity is being a father to my two wonderful daughters. In my podcast, Business Dad, I'm hoping to open up the conversation about balancing careers and family. The one thing I constantly hear successful people say, without fail, is that they wish they'd spent more time with their kids. That's time no one can get back. So I decided to create Business Dad, to engage in the conversation about how we're spending our time now, providing a forum for successful dads to share their joys and challenges of being a working parent. You'll get to hear from a wide range of business dads, from Rainn Wilson and Guy Raz to Todd Carmichael and Shane Battier. And while this podcast will talk about business and will definitely be featuring dads, I think everyone can learn something from these incredible conversations as we unpack the expectations we all have about careers, relationships, and ourselves. Business Dad is available now, so be sure to listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.